Hey, what up, Greg? This is BJ. I actually used to hang out with Freeman and Jamie, and it's awesome that you've been chilling with them. Yeah, I would love to talk to you about a recent vision I had on ayahuasca involving telepathically communicating to hundreds of dragons in outer space that are shape-shifting infinite beings. All right, homie, dude, take it easy. I'll talk to you later.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
How's it going, our side chatters? Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke, and I cannot wait to hear what people think of today's episode. I am Greg Carlwood from sunny San Diego. People who have been listening for some time might have noticed, but every once in a while, there's a certain type of show I like to do, and these are these in-depth looks at alternatives to how we look at the Earth and the events of the past. The Hollow Earth Theory with Dean Dominic DeLucia is an example of this. The Earth Crust Displacement Theory with Rand Flem Auth was another one. And they're not always easy to do because they involve stepping all over conventional ideas of science and geology and everything we've been taught. Well, today is one of these types of shows that attempts to take what we've been told from the mythology of cultures all around the world and the acknowledgement that much of the elite symbolism can be traced back to Saturn, as we've explored recently, and also many other random loose ends along the way that are left by the contradictions that have cropped up between the official schools of thought and certain evidence that's been discovered along the way. It is a great show. The guest is Troy McLaughlin, and we're diving into his Saturn Death Cult material, which is the name he gives for the elite, and we sort of gloss over the obvious connections between the elite and ritual sacrifice, child trafficking, and all the obvious reasons that a term like death cult could apply, and we focus more on trying to make a credible case for a model that allows for what is now Saturn to have once been the Earth's star, and not only that, but how a change in the environment, which introduced the new concepts of seasons and time into humanity's world, became the scapegoat and justification for the early elite priest class to form manipulative allegories around these events and also make changes to monetary systems that have been used to enslave humanity since the dawning of this proposed era. It is heavy stuff, and man, is it interesting to me. Troy is a great guest who I think has a scholarly and open approach to his perspective, and I just love it. And speaking of debt-based systems of monetary enslavement that affect us all, thanks to everyone who's been signing up for the new THC Plus a little early. And for those who didn't know, the new THC Plus show is going to be streamable and downloadable from the new website built to optimize the distribution of this show, both on the web and smartphone. And that website is thehiresidechatsplus.com. I am hoping, praying, sigil making, and invoking the humble entities of good fortune in an attempt to make manifest a reality where many of the listeners of THC will subscribe to a new extended 2-hour show with all the guests going forward for just $5 a month, and then I can start making my parents proud again. So please check it out and sign up when we hit August 1st and switch to the new longer format that I hope a lot of you are looking forward to. If $5 is too much, continue to enjoy the 1-hour show that will still remain free and more in line with what I've been doing up to date. And today, in fact, is actually an extended show. It's about 90 minutes because the material is so dense and expansive that an hour doesn't do it. So I'm excited to spend more time on these types of subjects more regularly. And while there are a lot of shows that do this, I hope you like the THC flavor just a little bit more. Of course, the money bomb is still growing strong. There will be 2 winners again with only a few days left before the winners are picked to be announced on the next 2 episodes. So get those donations in at thehiresidechats.com/donate. The last thing I want to bring up is that a lot of people have contacted me about the new theme song, and I've already gotten 3 or 4 good ones. This is very cool. Thanks so much. We heard the Let It Be cover on the last show, and I'd love people to keep sending me stuff. I think that I'm just going to cycle through them as they come in. Today I'm going to use one that I like as transition music, and maybe it will inspire some more submissions. So here we go with a solid crack at a new THC's theme song, and I'll be getting deep into what might be the most coveted secrets of the ancient past by the elitist elite with Troy McLaughlin on the other side.
The Higher Side Chats is where it's at, with everything you need to know, from corruption to UFOs. Sure to grab your weed and let's look at some conspiracies on THC, the Higher Side Chats.
All right, people, we've seen the signs and they've opened up our eyes. But while many researchers are doing great work recognizing the modern incarnations of secret society symbolism and tracing their origins as far back as they can, few researchers are making any progress on the big question of why the elite put so much careful consideration and planning into their hidden in plain sight symbolism, and why, at its core, it seems to have so much to do with Saturn, a distant planet that one would think should have gone largely unnoticed in the ancient times. Well, today's guest, Troy McLaughlin, puts the big unanswered why front and center in his research and has identified what he has called the Saturn Death Cult, which is also the name of both his book and website covering the topic. I've been diving into it for a few weeks now, and I'm really psyched to have him here. Troy, my man, how the hell are you?
I'm great, Greg. Pleasure to be with you on the show.
Yeah, man, this is going to be fun. I mean, it is some dense material that is completely foreign to most people, but we've had several guests recently who've kind of talked about this worship or homage of Saturn among the elites, sure. Like Mr. Gates and his audiobook Jupiter, and even Robert Morningstar mentioned that Saturn used to be more star-like. And these threads have danced around the topic, but you're going straight for the jugular here, man. And I think the best way to dive in to examine the reason for this fixation on Saturn among the elites is you got to walk us through your timeline of how you see the early solar system, because we know this symbology has something to do with hidden knowledge about the ancient past. And it seems like you might have cracked this case, right, Troy?
Well, I hope so. The book that I wrote, Saturn Death Cult, is largely inspired by a theory called Saturn theory, part of the electric universe model when it comes to looking at the cosmology associated with our solar system. But basically, Saturn Death Cult introduces the radical concept that ancient world mythology is actually the human witnessed record of a massively catastrophic rearrangement of the solar system into its current configuration. A rearrangement which, from the perspective of those witnessing it on Earth, saw the planet Saturn, which at that time was a sub-brown dwarf star, dislodged as Earth's original sun and replaced by our current sun. Now, this catastrophic episode is often referred to as Doomsday, and the events of that time are now subsequently indelibly imprinted into the human corporate psyche, where the various archetypes at a subconscious level have in turn been exploited by certain belief systems to give credence to various control type belief systems, usually those that promote an elitist worldview. And what this relates back to in terms of how it applies today is that mythology tells us Saturn ruled in what is known as the Golden Age, and it is the desire on the part of the elites to return to a form of this golden age that is at the basis of their thinking. And so what I hope to do with Saturn Death Cult is raise the reader's awareness as to the connection between these Saturnian-based belief systems and the emergence, ultimately, in our day, of the current debt-based financial system as typified by today's central banking model. Basically, something I argue is the ultimate enslavement system, where the productive majority of the Earth's population are subjected to the tyranny of an elite minority. But yeah, there are two things that make it difficult for a lot of people to first grasp these ideas, Greg. And one of them, it really is that we're talking about a complete rearrangement of the solar system within relatively recent times, within human memory. And the other one, of course, is that in the process of this rearrangement, the Earth starts out as originally being the satellite of a different star to the Sun, and that the Earth and that particular star were then catastrophically captured by the Sun to begin the process of this rearrangement of the solar system.
And that other star you mentioned, that's now the planet Saturn, correct?
Yes, that's right. Now, Saturn is called Saturn after the mythological god. And in Saturn theory, it's argued that they are one and the same. There is a detractors will say that the planets were named at a later date after gods. But the connection between the god Saturn and the planet Saturn can be established as being completely together in terms of the ancient mind. And I usually in an interview will read out a quote by probably the elder statesman of Saturn theory, a guy called Eduardo Cardona, which really should sum up what we're talking about here for your listeners.
And sure.
I quote now, the evidence of myth which points to Saturn having once occupied a position above Earth's north polar regions is voluminous. There is not a race on Earth that has not preserved at least one account which states as much. According to this evidence, Saturn occupied a central position in the north celestial regions. It rotated and rotated widely, but other than that, it was unmovable. Now, this was the original sun of ancient mythology. And because of the uniformitarian bias in science, it says the solar system has basically been as it is for billions of years, a slow changing thing.
Right.
You know, scholars have largely, they've recognized the association with the god Saturn with the pole star where it sits in the north today. But they've contrived to separate this idea that the ancients identified the actual planet as having been there. And this was done by a guy called John J. O'Neill about 140 years ago. And it just simply is a belief on their part that when they look up into the skies today, they can't see what the mythology is telling them. So they just discard it as being relevant to anything real that the ancients would have seen.
Right. Yeah, that's a classic problem with some of this stuff. And whether you're talking about some people who go into ancient alien theory and other ideas, we're finding out that a lot of the things that they knew about, they had real reference, even though we don't see it today. And this might have been the fact that we were revolving around Saturn. So take us back to that time. I mean, how long ago was this? Are we considering there's obviously humans on the planet, but it seems like,
Sure. Yeah,
I mean, what was life like then?
Okay, so what we're basically talking about is life under a sub-brown dwarf star. Now, I think what we need to do is, for the benefit of the listeners, is come to an understanding of what that actually means, what a sub-brown dwarf star is, and how a satellite, particularly one that could support life, could exist on something like that. Now, there is a physicist who is one of the more preeminent thinkers in the electric universe paradigm who has stated as such that if you were looking for life outside of the solar system, you would probably be best looking to see if you could find it around a sub-brown dwarf star. Now, these sub-brown dwarf stars are what you call substellar objects. They sit out there in space there. They don't glow like a star. Then, according to mainstream theory, they're not heavy enough to ignite the supposed nuclear furnace that drives our main sequence star, the Sun. But nonetheless, so they're basically what's called a cold object, and they're very, very difficult to detect. Now, between us and the nearest next main sequence star, we probably have a lot, anywhere between 600 to 1,000 of these things between us and them. And so therefore, what Wallace Thornhill argues is that if we went looking and applied electric universe principles for to sub-brown dwarf stars that are much closer, what we would find is an object that has what's called a plasma sheath wrapped around it. Now, I have to just give a little bit of a lesson in the Electric Universe here.
Yeah.
Okay. Basically, Electric Universe works on the basis that there are electric fields in space. And when objects of a different charge move through a much more positively charged electric space, they develop what's called a Langmuir sheath or a plasma sheath around it. This is something that can be demonstrated in labs and is known to all electrical engineers. And effectively, in our own solar system, that electric field is what we call the heliosphere. All right, and encompasses all the planets all the way out. I think the Viking probes have only just crossed the boundary now into the interstellar medium. And that is the sun's electric field. And when an object enters into that electric field that is negatively charged in relation to the sun, there will be a reaction. There will be a basically a discharge event and an equalizing of that object into the sun's more dominant electric field.
Mm-hmm.
Now, all stellar objects in the Electric Universe model are effectively what you would call discharge phenomenon. And a sub-brown dwarf star is a much lower discharge phenomenon compared to a main sequence star like the sun. So the Electric Universe argues that the sun is driven from without by the galactic electric current, as defined by Hans Alfvén, the Nobel Peace Prize winning physicist during the 1930s. And that energy drives the sun, and then basically we see this discharge phenomenon like a giant light bulb stuck in the sky. A sub-brown dwarf star, much smaller object, doesn't glow at that level at all. However, it does produce its own heliosphere. This plasmasphere is what I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
And if you if that sub-brown dwarf star has rocky satellites, those satellites can exist inside that plasmasphere. Now, that plasmasphere, like the sun's heliosphere, acts like a cocoon. And what it can do is it can create an environment within the sub-brown dwarf star's plasmasphere that is very conducive to life, simply because there is enough warmth there, there is enough radiant energy, and basically the light is uniform on the rocky surface.
Wow.
It's a dull world compared to the one that we live in terms of our daylight thing, but effectively you don't get the fluctuations of day and night on a satellite that exists there. What you have is you have a condition which is kind of like an eternal twilight. This is how a sub-round dwarf star in the electric model, universe model is perceived to behave. And when we look at mythology, we find that prior to the bursting forth of light, what a lot of us, you know, in the so-called Christian West, as we have it, the main mythology, of course, is the account in Genesis, the biblical account. And, of course, we know that moment where it says, let there be light, heralds mm-hmm. the beginning of so-called creation.
Yeah.
Now, this event, this flaring up of light, prior to that, there is a period, an unspecified time period of twilight darkness, a kind of a primordial glow that exists. And this is mirrored in virtually every other culture, this time before the sudden bursting forth of light in mythology. Is mirrored in other mythologies with the same conditions of eternal twilight that seems to stretch back into an unknowable past. Now, what Saturn theory argues is that when a sub-brown dwarf star comes into contact with the sun's heliosphere, i.e. the two plasmaspheres actually touch, the sub-brown dwarf star will discharge because it's basically a negatively charged object.
Mm-hmm.
And this will cause it to flare. It is this event that we trace in Saturn theory to the let there be light moment, where suddenly this sub-brown dwarf star flares and the inhabitants of one of its satellites are bathed in a radiant light, blinding light, that they've never, ever experienced before. This is what mythology tells us. This is what the Electric Universe model can demonstrate to be possible when a sub-brown dwarf star comes into the sun's influence.
Interesting. So in your research on the website, is this the time, this twilight time, the period you call the purple dawn?
That's correct, yeah. Okay. It's a generic term, the purple dawn, but it's basically if you have a T-class sub-brown dwarf star, they don't give off the ultraviolet and green light that the sun we see gives off. And what you get is you get light more in the blue and red spectrums. As a result of that, you get a world which is predominantly would be bathed in a purple hue, a reddish blue hue throughout that sort of has a dull glow. Effectively, to get a sense of the light, I always tell people the best place to get a sense of this would be to dive down to about 15 meters under the ocean, open your eyes in a clear piece of ocean, and just get a sense of how murky and dim it would be. That's the kind of light that we're talking about that would have that basically would be put out by a sub-brown dwarf star. Now, what I think, to let people get an idea of what we're talking about here, okay? A sub-brown dwarf star is an object that is not much bigger than the planet Jupiter, okay? Now, Jupiter itself has four terrestrial satellites, rocky satellites, going around it. It has its own, what mainstream science calls its radiation field. That is Jupiter's plasma sphere in the Electric Universe paradigm. And these four satellites, these four rocky satellites, one of which is almost the size of Mars, all exist within that radiation sphere that Jupiter emits today. So that if Jupiter were at the sub-brown dwarf level, and there's every reason to believe it once was a sub-brown dwarf of some type, then its radiation sphere is its plasma sphere, and it's got four rocky planets orbiting within that cocoon. So to help people picture that, just think of Jupiter in that sense. We're arguing that Saturn was a free-floating example of exactly this, a sub-brown dwarf star. We argue that before contact with the sun's plasma sphere, its own plasma sphere, that Saturn's plasma sphere, was opaque and didn't allow light to get in from the outside. So whatever rocky bodies were on the inside had no perception of anything that was outside their own experience under Saturn. Mm-hmm. Now this correlates perfectly even with the biblical model, where I think it is the third day. Correct me if I'm wrong. It might be the third or the fourth day, when the sun and the stars are actually seen. Mm-hmm. According to that, now, if you're talking about a sub-brown dwarf star undergoing a discharge event, going nova-like on contact with a higher electric field, that plasma sphere would equalize and would become transparent. So you would get a flaring effect that would bathe the terrestrial body inside in brilliant light. When that light settles down as the sub-brown dwarf star equalizes, the opaque plasma sphere has been made transparent, and suddenly the whole of the cosmos is now able to be seen. And again, this correlates very nicely with the mythological record, where in many of the cultures, and I'm talking about all around the world, not just the Western traditions and so on, the sun is a non-existent sun, then it is a distant sun, before it finally comes into its place of prominence. In the meantime, Saturn has flared, and then over a period of time, it loses its position the dominant object in the Earth's sky.
Wow. See, this is really interesting, but how long do these changes take to occur? Because we are so used to this paradigm that it takes millions and billions of years for change to occur, and that, you know, life can't exist if the temperature were to raise 10 degrees or lower 10 degrees. Apparently, we're made to think that we're in this very slim sliver of possibility where life could exist. And to hear that celestial bodies are bouncing around all over the place, it seems so foreign from the traditional concept.
Sure. The uniformitarian prejudice that there is in science, you know, the idea that things only change over gradual extended periods of times, it's the dominant train of thought.
Right.
And this mitigates strenuously against it. Saturn theory is largely born out of comparative mythology. It is the electric universe model that has developed after comparative mythologists started looking and saying, hey, the ancients saw a different sky, but that must have been, that's impossible. They couldn't have. All right. So what was it about the ancient sky that they saw? It must have been that they, you know, usually it's discarded as overactive imaginations, ritualistic concerns and things like that. But the electric universe paradigm gives a model whereby suddenly you are no longer hemmed in or held to the ground, so to speak, by a gravity-only driven universe. Suddenly there's this other force out there that is transmitted by plasma, which is the most ubiquitous substance in the universe. And these electrical and electromagnetic forces override gravity in the process and provide a model for sudden changes. Now, the father of this kind of thought is a guy called Immanuel Velikovsky, and he pioneered this sort of work in a book called Worlds in Collision back in the 1950s. And he was absolutely eviscerated by the mainstream scientific community. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter that a lot of his predictions, which were poo-pooed at the time, were had subsequently been he's been exonerated by them coming true. I think probably the most famous one was his prediction that Jupiter would emit radio waves. This is because Velikovsky sensed that for things to happen according to mythology, there had to be an electrical component to the forces that govern the solar system. Hmm. And in his day, the solar system was this inert system held entirely by gravity. You couldn't get electrical potentials, in space. And this has turned out to not be true. Of course, it's never acknowledged mm-hmm. That he was the one who came up with that. He made a lot of mistakes, but being a pioneer, that's exactly what happens.
Right.
But the mainstream approach to him is no different than as if we completely rejected Galileo because he made the mistake of identifying Saturn's rings as two moons.
Right.
And we say, right, okay, well, we have nothing more to do with his ideas.
This electric universe model is super interesting because this kind of touches on people who know the Tesla story. It seems like what he was touching on, because he would say that electricity is everywhere, that it's in the air, that our universe is made up of it. And as opposed to the other side where Edison wanted to charge money for it and considered it not so prevalent of a resource that had to travel through these wires that he could meter and charge for. But is this related to what Tesla was trying to talk about at all?
Undoubtedly. Probably the more poignant scientist to be talking about in relation to that is a guy called Christian Birkeland. He was a Norwegian scientist who made some experiments with iron balls in a laboratory where he ran high voltage through them. And lo and behold, he was able to create the aurora effects that we see around the polar regions of the Earth. Now, the reason he was rejected, and this is over 100 years ago that he was doing these experiments, he was rejected because science just could not conceive where the electrical current came from. And, it's one of those things, Greg, where in terms of basic science, we have what's called a dynamo model for the Earth, where it's believed that somehow a molten iron core is spinning enough to create the electrical current that drives our magnetic field. Now, everybody who's done a bit of science knows that magnetism is a result of electrical current. It's not a natural occurring thing unless there is an electrical current. So if you have a magnetic field, there either is an existing electrical current or there was once upon a time an electrical current, and that produced the magnetic fields, because that, you know, that's how we create a magnet out of a nail. We wrap it around a wire, run an electrical current through it, and suddenly it becomes magnetic. The same thing with the Earth. Now, what Birkeland and Tesla largely discovered independent of each other, without really knowing the full effect, is that the sun puts out this electrical field, and that currents go from the sun's southern pole to the Earth's southern pole through the Earth, and then arcs back again through the Earth's north pole to the sun's north pole, and the cycle, you know, completes. It's basically a circuit. And this circuit is what we call Birkeland currents, and is now starting to be recognized. People are starting to understand it exists. They know it exists between Jupiter and Io, one of its moons. They're fully aware of it being there. But it would take a few years before Hannes Alfvén, the Nobel Peace Prize winner that I mentioned before, would develop his model called the Electric Galactical Circuit, in which the whole galaxy is really a giant unipolar electric motor. And basically where we are in one of the spirals of their arm is, you know, within that whole massively huge electrical flow that is generated by the galaxy.
Man, this is like, you know, New Science 101.
It's totally different. Don't take this to your mainstream guys. For them, there's a black hole at the center of the galaxy. For Electric Universe people, it's a unipolar motor.
Man, so in terms of the elite secrets, because that's pretty much what we're talking about here, is we're talking about they have some hidden knowledge of the ancient past, which in this case very well could be the Saturn theory, which hinges on the Electric Universe. So obviously we have to lay that base. It is a really dense and far-reaching topic that, you know, a lot of layers to it have to be revealed. But let's talk about, I kind of want to know what life was like when it was still under Saturn. Like, what was it like environmentally on the Earth?
Okay, I mean, this is actually my favorite topic in terms of the research and so on, okay?
Perfect.
Because you're talking about life under a sub-brown dwarf star. So let's, for argument's sake, say we've accepted that Earth began under a sub-brown dwarf star before its capture by the sun. What kind of environment? First of all, we have to get the configuration right. One of the things within Saturn theory, there are competing ideas for how satellites under a sub-brown dwarf would behave. Mythology tells us that Saturn resided north, that basically where we see the pole star today was always the position where Saturn was, this dull glow, this orb that existed up there.
Would you say it was about the size of the moon, or larger or smaller?
What, Saturn at that time?
Yeah.
Oh, much larger.
Much larger.
Yeah, but you see, if you were outside of the plasmasphere, okay, you would, and you were looking at this object in infrared, it would be hard to actually see inside the plasmasphere in the same way it's hard to see from the inside out. And that, so the object would look a lot bigger than its actual core is. But the core of Saturn at that time would be probably about a third larger than it is today. So a bit bigger than Jupiter is today that we see it. And if you're going to have an object that size residing as a dull glowing disk at celestial north, all right, this is not magnetic north, it's not geometric north or anything, it's actually celestial north, as I say, where today we see the pole star roughly. If you're going to have that, there are only two configurations you can have. One is called phase lock, and that's like the moon, the same, the moon's relationship to the Earth that we have. The same face of the moon always faces the Earth, all right? So that the moon revolves in relation to the sun, but it doesn't revolve in relation to us. We see the same side the whole time. This is called phase lock. as opposed to like the Earth, which spins on its axis while it is rotating around the sun. But the moon is an example of phase lock. And for many people in Saturn theory, this is their solution for why the Earth saw Saturn in the north celestial regions when it was a satellite of Saturn. I favor another one, which is championed by Eduardo Cardona, which is what's called the polar alignment or the polar configuration. And what that is the idea that Saturn is rotating on its axis, the Earth is rotating on its axis, and there is an axial alignment. Imagine like the axle of two wheels linking the two planets.
Okay, yeah.
So effectively, Earth is dangling underneath Saturn, where both are spinning on their axis, but they're kept in that kind of stasis with each other. And subsequently, anybody on Earth would see Saturn always at its celestial north. If you were from Saturn's perspective, you would see Earth always in Saturn's celestial south.
Huh. Would that make the poles warm?
It certainly would.
Because there is ancient stories of the poles having like greenery and all that kind of stuff up there. That might be an explanation.
Well, not only is the celestial north identified as the abode of gods, but the navel of the Earth, the contact with the abode of the gods, is always placed in the north, whatever culture you're involved in. You know, this is a very common thing, particularly, obviously, Nordic cultures have it big time. But, you know, in Greek culture, it's the Mount Olympus. The Chinese have it with their god, whose name escapes me, Tong, the Yellow Emperor, as he's known. There's always this association with the far north. And the far north is often associated with kind of the origin of paradise, if you know what I mean. So yes, if you have a configuration, and of course for many people, the idea of polar configured celestial bodies is an absolute aberration in terms of Newtonian mechanics. But in a recent book, along with a co-author, we've put out a paper that shows that actually in the universe as it is, what we see polar aligned bodies all over the place. It's just knowing what you what to look for. And we're talking about Herbig-Harrab objects, which people can look up and go and see what they're about. But the point is that, yes, there is a physics for polar alignment, even if we haven't seen two actual planetary bodies engaged in that. But there are examples, which we can get into later if we want to cover that. But let's say, for argument's sake, that we're in this polar environment. Yes, if Saturn is a sub-round dwarf, the majority of its radiation would fall on the polar north of the Earth at that particular time. The rest of the Earth would still receive a uniform radiation in terms of the radiation and light reflected back off the plasmasphere, which is this, you know, as we discussed before, the giant cocoon encompasses both bodies. But the place to be in that environment is, of course, the north. If you really want the real resort area at that time, it's also the most dangerous place to be if the sub-brown dwarf goes unstable. And that's the problem with sub-brown dwarfs. They're not stable. They're not like our main sequence star, the sun. Sub-brown dwarfs are an unstable type of star, and they're prone to flare. So yes, you want to be there when the sub-brown dwarf star is quiet, but you wouldn't want to be there if it was affected in any way, if something, you know, triggered it to flare in any way.
Hmm.
But yes, it does seem that the megafauna of the Earth and much of the growth. See, one of the anomalies is that we know that the ice ages, vast swathes of Russia, Alaska, were never under glacial, influence right. at that time. The Arctic Ocean itself is, paradoxically, it is the muckiest, most organically filled ocean on the planet. There's a whole lot of stuff in the Arctic Ocean that has rotted away and created this soup that is up there. And, of course, we have this whole anomaly of why have we got mammoths that need to eat, you know, literally hundreds of pounds of food, temperate tropical food, and they have this temperate tropical food in their stomachs, the ones that have been preserved and found. What are they doing up in a place that in today's world is a completely desolate, icy waste? Yeah. How does a mammoth survive given the the current flora that you've got up there? I mean, crikey, they come up with, oh, they dug it out with their tusks and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, this is nonsense. Yeah. As far as anybody who knows how an elephant needs to do. But they all seem to have gravitated towards those northern climes and so on. The trouble is, when the flare comes, you're at ground zero for a major atmospheric discharge event.
Yeah, that's quite a gamble for that type of environment to live up there. But so let me ask you, because we're referencing mythology and that's where we're figuring out where this stuff comes from, and it's in cultures all over the world. But how long ago is this? Is this 10,000 years ago? Is this longer or shorter?
Well, it's always, I'm a bit dubious when people start, you know, dating stuff down to even with a millennium, right, with these things. But I'm quite happy to go on the record that 10,000 years ago is what I place as the doomsday event. All right. That doomsday event is when Saturn is finally, when the coupling, the axial alignment between Saturn and Earth was severed. All right. And the Earth found itself on its own, now revolving around the main sequence star we call the Sun. All right. And Saturn is lost, is banished to the outer realms. Now, I put that event at around about 10,000 years ago. The beginning of what we call the Golden Age, in other words, that event marks the end of the Golden Age. So the Golden Age, and probably I believe is a period anywhere between 1,000 and 5,000 years long, all right? Now, that age represents the period of capture when the sub-brown dwarf star called that is to become Saturn is being captured by the Sun, still maintains its relationship with the Earth, and is sort of discharging, flaring, and creating this this glow on the Earth that, coupled with the Sun, introduces this brand new era, this entirely new environment for humans to experience. That Golden Age exists about, give or take, 1,000 to 6,000 years. It's unclear as to how long that lasted. Prior to that, so getting on, let's say, 16,000 years ago, all right, prior to that is what we call the Purple Dawn era, this era that we refer to as when the Earth was entirely alone in its relationship to Saturn. There was no Sun. Now, this coincides with extinction events with the megafauna, as they're called, the giant mammals that we see. Mm-hmm. And this brings up another aspect, Greg, that in terms of life on an Earth-sized body under a sub-brown dwarf star. In the electric universe, gravity is an electrostatic phenomenon. It's not just simply mass and weight. This is complete heresy in mainstream science, so don't take it to your university professors or anything like that. But nonetheless, that's what the electric universe model stipulates as it is. As a result of that, it can be said that Earth under Saturn would have had a completely different gravity, a much less gravity. And it is this less gravity that allowed for mega-sized creatures, mega-sized flora to start existing.
Dinosaurs and stuff too, I'm sure, right?
Well, yes, because what you get, remember I told you a sub-brown dwarf star is a very variable, it has a tendency to flare and so on, all right?
Mm-hmm.
If you go back through time into this Purple Dawn time, and almost without exception, you find that all these creatures have a tendency towards nocturnal living, all right? It's one of those things that doesn't make much sense, on the Earth when you look at the way that they're constructed and what their eyesight and smell and so on is like. A lot of these creatures, including the dinosaurs, are best suited to a nocturnal environment. Now, if this sub-brown dwarf star is having periodic flare-ups. In other words, while it's drifting out there alone in space, it's meeting other objects, electrically speaking, and it has flare-ups, then you are going to get changes in gravity. And it seems that as the gravity changes and gets, you know, it gets heavier, you get extinction events. And if there's one thing that you can actually correlate down through the line, it's sort of like bigger becomes smaller over time. Each extinction event sees the bigger creatures go, followed by another extinction level event where the next lot of big creatures, but slightly smaller, they go, right down to our mammoths, right down to all those mammalian megafauna that that we've seen, that we date at roughly between 10,000 and 20,000 years ago in terms of their extinction events.
Wow.
So we're arguing for the idea that there's been an attenuation of gravity in terms of Earth's relationship to Saturn. And now that we've entered into the relationship with the sun, we're at the gravity we're at this moment. And that's why dinosaurs and huge creatures like that just simply wouldn't survive in the world that we have today. They're too heavy to support themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's also a lot of researchers that are finding skeletons of human-like giants that also could play into that, because that's an unexplained thing too. A lot of people give it credit. They give credit to the Nephilim or some type of alien race, but it could have just been humans from this time where we were in the Purple Dawnish era.
Yes, the human species was definitely much more robust in earlier times, even going back to, you know, what used to be called Cro-Magnon man and such. You know, they were a much more robust species and so on. You know, it comes back down to that whole sort of debate. Why, when size is such a winning ticket, you know, when to be big, to be the biggest, was evolutionary, you know, speaking, you know, the big thing. Why are we not seeing that happen today? Why are we not seeing a growth towards size, particularly in land-based creatures? It's a disturbing problem for many of the people who, you know, they're discovering even bigger dinosaurs almost every year. There's a new one that's even bigger than the last one. And, you know, it was sort of like about three, 4 decades ago, we reached the point where scientists understood that particularly the dinosaur types that fly, that this in the current environment we have now, if that's what they lived in when they were alive, they just couldn't do what they seemed to be designed to do. They literally would have collapsed under the pressure of their own weight.
Yeah, that's interesting, man. So I want to, you mentioned this golden age. Is this in mythology a time where they're talking about the Garden of Eden, like where life is flourishing? Because it seems to be like that's a big part that people talk about in all their ideas of this pastime. There seems to be something there.
Yeah. Well, you see, Saturn is the word that we use it's a generic term. It's actually the Romans term for the Greeks called their god Kronos. It's where we get time from, you know, chronology and such like that. You know, I've got a list somewhere around here of all the different cultures' names for their version of Saturn. All right. So what you have is you have all these cultures that have a version of Saturn, and their version of Saturn always presides over a life-giving epoch, this time of lack of want. All right. So Saturn is associated with bringing forth light, bringing forth creation, creating a world that was an earthly paradise for people to exist. Mm-hmm. He also becomes the Merchant of Doom, the Slayer, the Great Reaper, the Grim Reaper. Saturn is associated with a scythe, which is where we get our Grim Reaper archetype from, mm-hmm. In terms of modern mythology. And that is because what he created, he also took away when he died, when he was ousted from his throne. All right. And that period when Saturn ruled, depending on whatever culture you go to, is recognized as, you know, that was the time you wanted to live in. That was the time you wanted to exist. And subsequent to that time, with the doomsday event, most cultures have developed, you know, a variant, a benevolent and a malevolent variant of the idea. What can we do to bring back, to recapture that time of lack of want, that earthly paradise?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the what I would call the benevolent types, particularly in what I refer to in Saturn Death Cult as the Silver Age, where priesthoods first started to codify laws and so on, the idea was to create, you know, a society that observed certain laws and to the benefit of all. And primary to that, of course, is the idea that weights and measures are all equal, that, you know, you don't apply different weights and measures to different people. Everybody gets to operate off the same weights and measures.
Okay.
The malevolent variation on that says, hey, no, I want that lifestyle in the golden age, and the best way to get it is to get everybody else to do the work. All right? And how am I going to get all these people to do this? Because, you know, if I try the tough guy route, get a bunch of thugs, eventually they overthrow you. They rise up because you need a majority to support a minority who wants to live in a you know, in the sort of golden age type lifestyle. So they've had to come up with various other ways to enslave people, you know, to basically provide this lifestyle so they have it at the top. And of course, the way to do that is to subvert the weights and measures by which people trade, by which people, you know, create their laws and operate with each other, and to subvert it in such a way that the majority of people become indebted to those who would like to live this golden age lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is why Saturn Death Cult leads into the idea that the interest-based financial debt system, a system which, if you look at the major religions of the world, was always condemned as an abomination. It's this very system that is probably the most efficient means for ensuring that people will willingly work in such a way that they provide all the productive benefit,
yeah,
for an elite that just sits there and rakes in the benefits.
Absolutely. I'm in total agreement with you there that that is one of the root problems we have. And it's interesting to think that this spawned out of a desire for the people in charge to get back to a time where everyone had abundance because of the environment on the planet. It's a fascinating idea. And that's what I kind of wondered, because if Saturn was, or this sub-brown dwarf star was responsible for this abundance, you would think that it would be a Saturn life cult, not necessarily a Saturn death cult. You'd think they would want good for everybody. But yeah, when you break it down into those two different types, it's really interesting, because there also seems to be a link between the three various religions of the world and different systems of different monetary systems. I guess, can you break that down a little bit for us?
Yeah, it's, you know, the elite, you know, whatever it is when it comes to Saturn, you know, even if they themselves knew this theory that I'm espousing as such, which I doubt many of them do, all they know is that in the time of Saturn, it was wonderful, and they're gonna get a piece of that for themselves at the expense of all of us. But, you know, this is where it's so important to understand that when Saturn, you know, it's not like they're going to drag a sub-brown dwarf and place it up at the north again, and they're going to go back to that.
Right.
They're just after a lifestyle.
Yes.
All right. Okay. So the resource, rather than a sub-brown dwarf providing it for us, a la Saturn, their resource becomes the rest of us. Now, the reason they can get away from this, and this is what I hope people take out of Saturn Death Cult, the reason that they can, and this is what the reason why I call it Saturn Death Cult, the reason they can get away with this is because when you had the catastrophic event Doomsday, the moment, the time when Saturn was dislodged from its position, it was immensely catastrophic. It's what's at the heart of the Atlantis legends. It's you know, it's that time in the Bible when Adam and Eve are cast out from the Garden of Eden and so on, right? And when you get this event, it leaves an indelible print in the people's subconscious. It's a how can I call it? It creates archetypes, and what happens is that afterwards you get priests, you get people who try to codify laws out of that time, and the authority that they claim is represented by their knowledge of the symbols that have come down to us from this event. All right. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the way that Saturn is represented, having knowledge of that representation gives you a certain amount of authority, because people think to themselves, gee, it would be good to get back to that time. Everybody wants to get back to that time. Most of us understand you've got to have a fair and equitable system for all of us to get back to some kind of golden age. But it's these symbols that come out of that time, these archetypes, the father god, the heroic Mars, and doomsday itself, the ultimate archetype. But most importantly, the all-seeing eye that was Saturn when it was up above, you know, something we missed talking about was that configuration. It would look like a giant eyeball up in the sky. Mm-hmm. But that all-seeing eye that is no longer there, if you're wearing that kind of insignia, you know, people assume it triggers subconscious reactions.
Yeah, inside. Like a genetic memory almost.
Yeah. And this is cross-cultural. I don't care what race or ethnic group or religion you belong to, it triggers these reactions in all of us. And these guys know this. They might not know the actual cosmology behind it, all right, but they know what it does. And it only takes somebody to go, aha, I've got a shortcut here if I'm willing to exploit other people.
Right.
And they use these symbols and these archetypes. And particularly in the modern age, they saturate our lives with these symbols. And the result is basically a subliminal control mechanism.
Right. And obviously the control mechanism is the monetary structures. And I've heard you
talk... Well, that's the mechanism. Yeah, sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, I've heard you talk about the Jubilee concept and the introduction of usury. Does this come out of these elite from... I mean, it's kind of related to this, correct?
Yeah. Well, you see, if we take the what's called the Judeo-Christian thing, and I think, you know, most people listening here, anybody with, you know, from the English-speaking world sort of can grasp concepts from that tradition better than if I started talking about, let's say, Maori culture in New Zealand or you know, Mesoamerican culture in South America. All right. Okay. Right. But if we take that Judeo-Christian concept, all right, what we see is we see two competing systems, all right? One, a system that is considered to be of God and espoused by his prophets, his priests, and so on down the line. And then another system, which is sort of this economic system espoused by man and is represented by the city of Babylon, all right? Or, you know, down through ancient time and so on. Now, if we just forget about all the biblical details and so on, what we're being told here is that there is a battle between a benevolent priesthood approach to understanding what it was that the Golden Age represented, all right, and what we can do to get back to a Golden Age. And then you have a subversive, malevolent system, which says basically that you can use the very same symbols and archetypes, but you can use them in such a way as to, you know, to control people and so on. Now, in the benevolent system, when it comes to the use of money and debt and so on, they operate what's called the Jubilee system, which is that all debts are cancelled every 49 years. It varies depending on what Middle Eastern tradition you have. But nonetheless, they have this idea. The malevolent system says, no, you are in debt, and if you can't pay, I take it all, and you know, and I will take it from your children, and your children will have to pay, and your children's children, and so on. All right. Now, if you're the type of person who sees that as the road to ensuring you get, you know, that survival, fight or flight sort of mentality, I'm going to accumulate to myself and my own. All right. That malevolent system is the one you're going to choose. And it's the one you're going to practice and try and bring onto society over time. And it's this battle down through the ages between these two types of thought that that we see culminating in today's, in my opinion, in today's financial crisis, where we are at a level now which is probably only been reached on two occasions in history to the level that we're on the precipice of now. One in the 1340s, when Europe was decimated by the Black Death as a result of shenanigans going with the banks collapsing, that producing famine, the famine producing the weakness that made people susceptible to disease, the disease turning up. And, stories from that time, you really would have thought it was the apocalypse. You have cities of 700,000 in the space of 3 months being reduced to seven people. You know, it's absolutely diabolical. The other one, of course, comes down to us from history, which is the fall of the Tower of Babel.
Mm-hmm.
That is the other event. And we seem to go through this process as a species. We let these creatures who would accumulate to themselves, we give them the power to do so by giving them the power to issue debt-based money. And it builds up and it builds up, and here we are. We're on the precipice.
Right. Yeah. That's super interesting, because the benevolent system, the Jubilee system, obviously has gone by the wayside in modern times, it seems. But is this where we get? Because I remember in going to private school, the idea of forgiving 70 times seven, all that stuff. Is that related to their system of money in this?
Totally.
Okay.
Yeah. That's the benevolent system, okay? The idea is 7 times 7, 49. Every 49th year, all debts are canceled, everything. No buts.
Wow.
All right? Everything starts again, all right? The Persians practiced it a bit different. Whenever a new king came to the throne, a jubilee happened. So if the king ruled 30 years, you had to wait 30 years. If you ruled 5 years, you waited 5 years. In the biblical system as practiced by the ancient Israelites, and not very well, it would seem, but nonetheless, the system that they looked at doing, every seventh year was a rest year, all right, and every 49th year was a total cancellation year of all debts. This is interesting because there are people who are not religious. They're not associated with big-time Christian agendas or Muslim agendas or Jewish agendas and so on. They're hardcore economists, and they've reached a point where they talk about a jubilee system solution. Often they refer to it as a reset.
Mm-hmm.
And this does seem to be gaining popularity. And in my opinion, I was reading the other day a guy doing a blog, and I think he hit it on the head when he said that one day we will look back at central banking and its fiat debt based financial system, and we will regard it the same way we regard the institution of slavery.
Mm.
We will look back on it and just wonder what the hell were those people doing, allowing these guys to run a system that indebted the world to the detriment of the vast majority.
Right.
You know, it's quite incredible.
And the debt-based system is bad enough considering – the money is being made in the hands of a few, but then you introduce interest or usury and people are supposed to pay back more than they received. Well, they can't print their own money. So where does that money come from? You know, it's a system where you can never fully escape the debt.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it is the interest. It is the usurious element that makes it debt based. And, you know, I've often said to people, and you may have heard me sort of bang on about this in other interviews or something, along those lines. But, if somebody came to you and said, look, I've got these 10 things, I'm going to lend them to you. There's only 10 of them in the world. But at the end of the year, you're going to have to give them back. But I want 11 of them.
Right.
And if you don't give me 11, I'm going to take your house. I'm going to take everything. All right.
Right.
You would say, yeah, thanks, but no thanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, in very simplistic terms, that's the con that we're under with central banking. That's what they did at the Jekyll Island when they instituted the Federal Reserve in America. It's how the Bank of England was set up. Wherever you see this model, that's what it is in its simplistic form. It's not run that way because they finance the ability to pay back the debt with more debt. And so the national debt increases. That's why we have these ridiculously astronomical national debts plaguing us at this time. It's just purely because they just keep financing the debt to get us more and more in debt, right, as we go along. And, you know, that's where we're at, you know, things today.
And it's interesting to think that the monetary system spawned out of a change in the environment, because it's like whether we were in the cocoon of this sub brown dwarf star or revolving around our current sun, couldn't you implement the same type of control regardless?
No, you couldn't, because okay, so this is what's important to understand, all right? When you're in the Purple Dawn era, okay, what happens is you have no reference to celestial objects, so there's no concept of time in such an environment.
Okay,
nothing revolves around anything. You can't march, you can't create, understand time. You can maybe do so at a very limited basis at a local level, but you can't sort of say to somebody, "Look, I'll see you in 5 days' time."
All right? No reference.
There aren't any days' time or anything like that. Okay,
yeah.
You don't have that capacity. Now, that's how the Purple Dawn thing happens. But the thing is that you still have an environment, and this is getting back to our Earth at that time. You have an environment that is basically a one-season environment. So you have a perpetual harvest going on, okay? And nobody can institute a system of enslavement on people when they can just simply move away and get food.
Yeah.
They don't have to worry about shelter because it's a very benign environment. There's very little wind and so on and that. But, you know, you can't sort of, you know, say that. When you get to the Golden Age, where the Saturn flares up and the sun makes its appearance and starts to encroach on Saturn's territory and knocks it out. But during that time, you still have vestiges of this one season world. But also with the sun's warming rays coming in and so on, you still have this situation where food is abundant. You're not going to be able to blackmail people on the basis that they that there is a scarcity of food, okay? Mm-hmm. And so what happens, though, is that because the cosmos has now been revealed at large, they can see the sun, they can see the stars, they have the full zodiac, you know, points of the of the constellations and so on like that. All this stuff allows people to create the concept of time. And with the concept of time, with measure, and that's why the Greeks call, that's why Saturn in the Greek, in most cultures, he's called the father of time, the god of time. Time is a measure. And once you start being able to measure things, you have the ability to create civilization. You move from just existing day to day and feeding yourself on what's available to this existence where you can measure, you can explore, you can map, you can survey your land. But you still lack for want. You've got food wherever you know you need it. There's
yeah.
no sort of shortage. However, when Saturn leaves the scene and is replaced by the sun, we enter into a seasonal world. And I think the Bible best sums it up when it talks about, by the sweat of your brow will you make the earth yield its fruits, all right? So suddenly you've got to actually make an effort to get the fruits out of land, because for 6 months of the year, nothing's growing, mm-hmm. all right?
Yeah.
And with the introduction of that, you get the introduction of scarcity. And where you've got scarcity, you've got the potential for exploitation.
Wow. Wow, that is a great explanation. It's so weird to think about, because I think about all the frustrating things of our modern society, and to think it would be rooted in that environmental change is just pretty new to me. It's pretty mind-blowing, man.
Well, again, it comes back to that whole thing. You know, when you've been told the solar system has basically had the same, we've had the same sky for billions of years, even before humans existed, this is how the sky would have looked. the idea that you have a catastrophic rearrangement of the of the planets in general, the idea that not only is there a rearrangement, but Saturn and Earth are actually interlopers. They're aliens coming in and being introduced into the system. When you have all that as part of the process to explain why mythology tells us this change happened, it's all a bit, it almost sounds preposterous,
right?
To most people. And I think that's where the problem exists. Now, in writing Saturn Death Cult, I was aware that the same resources are available to me as there are to this culture I call the Saturn Death Cult, this culture that allows people to exploit others by utilizing archetypes and symbols, all right? Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things that I found, while it's a highly niche topic, by introducing these ideas, I also have those archetypes and symbols at my disposal. And it's funny because you're presenting the same symbols but with a different explanation. And, it's my opinion that the result is that this tends to – I hear terms like, hey, it resonates with me and it's all that. To me, it is just purely and simply that the archetypes have been triggered in your subconscious, but you're being presented with a way of thinking about them that has a natural explanation rather than the way that some of the more nefarious examples, the more degenerative examples, or the ones that go down the ritualistic route, present these very same symbols. And I think that appeals to people who, at least to people who aren't psychopaths.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about these two financial systems, because of course today we're dominated by the one, the fractional reserve banking system. Is there any more details you have about the competition between these two systems? When did the benevolent system kind of disappear?
Well, the benevolent system disappears, I believe, around about 600 BC, whereby it's, you really have to dig deep into, whichever text or whichever culture you're into. In the Judeo-Christian world, of course, we've got our biblical references, and the Muslim world also takes most of its it's mostly informed from those very same references. Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism in China and so on also makes references to these kinds of systems where an interest-bearing system, money system, is decried. And it's there in the texts. But what happens is that you get a symbiosis develop between people who want to exploit the system by subverting the measure that is money, because that's what people have to understand. Money is a measure. It measures the work done. If we say something is it costs a dollar, we're saying it's a dollar's worth of work has been put into that service or that good, and that's the measure of it. Okay, so if you subvert the measure, mm-hmm. You basically control how the measure is pays out. You get to control the dividend. And because the temples of the ancient priesthoods were the source of how these weights and measures were allocated and how they were defined, we have to remember that Moses, the lawgiver in the Bible, was highly, highly focused on weights and measures. In terms of how he envisaged the ancient Israelite society to work. And the same through many of the traditions in the other cultures, you get this idea. Now, if you subvert the temple where the priests who are responsible for that, if you go in and start subverting the temple in terms of subverting these weights and measures, then you can hide behind their credibility, this credibility that we're talking, this legitimacy that comes from them being associated with these archetypes. They're drawn from the Golden Age. And for anybody who wants to see how this mechanism works, and I have to recommend Joseph P. Farrell's book, Babylon's Banksters. He outlines the way through society. This is an ongoing thing. There is this thing where the temples are subverted. The temples issue money. Gold comes in against the money to back the money. The receipts against the gold are forged. Then the gold becomes the means of exchange. And then the gold itself is then replaced by fiat, down through later on, which is then entirely controlled by these people operating behind the temple. There's a reason the central banks all exist in buildings that look like temples. It's part of their heritage.
Yeah.
You know, this is where it all stems from.
So, well, I don't want to get too racy, but, you know, you hear in the conspiracy world, the Jewish banking conspiracy is a big one. And there are stereotypes that apply to that faith or those people that are usually involving money and being miserly and that kind of thing. Does this is this rooted in the introduction of usury and interest in ancient times?
No, it's actually more a modern thing, and it's a very unfortunate result. I mean, I'm of Scottish heritage, and we have our miserly stereotype and all that sort of thing. But what's been placed on the Jewish sort of idea, and you know, just as a comment on that, you know, I've looked into the idea that it's dominated by Jews, and yes, you see Jewish people at the top. But when I looked closely into it, there are just as many white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, WASPs, involved in this game as anybody else. In other words, it seems to me that whatever your ethnic background, everybody's susceptible to the love of money. Mm-hmm. And you know, they go with it. The problem for the Jewish situation is that in the Bible under Moses, when it comes to lending money, there's basically a law that says you shall not lend at interest, but you can lend at interest to the foreigner. Okay? All right? So if a foreigner comes in and wants to borrow money from you, you can lend at interest to them. Now, the problem with this is that it's a misunderstanding of what the law is trying to actually say. What it's saying is this, is that the Israelites are supposed to have a non-interest money-based system. But if somebody from outside of that system comes in and borrows money, they can borrow money at no interest, take that money into their system, lend the interest, make a massive profit, and pay back at no interest. It's called a carry trade.
Okay.
All right. Okay. So the idea is that Israel, being an example to all other peoples, it wouldn't want to give somebody, a foreigner, the advantage over their own people by giving them a free source of interest-free loans. Mm-hmm. Okay? All right? So if the foreigner comes in and so on, and he won't subject himself to Israel's laws, and he wants to borrow money to take back to his own country, that interest law is there to ensure he doesn't benefit from a carry trade at the expense of his own people. The problem is down through the Middle Ages, those in the Jewish community who got into that just simply saw it as a way of exploiting what they call the goyim, the Gentiles.
Uh-huh.
All right. And, you know, this is unfortunate because at that time, the Christian West in particular actually had a prohibition on usury through the Catholic Church. Nobody could lend at usury. So there was no need on the part of the Jewish people to do this. And, you know, a research into it shows that many Jews have actually, down through the ages, I'm talking about in the Middle Ages, decried this practice on that basis. But, you know, it got the better of certain Jews, and they just couldn't resist the temptation to lend at interest and so on. And, so subsequently the reputation in times of dire need, particularly the 1340s and so on, introduces a stereotype where people go, hey, it's the Jews' fault. But, you know, if you go and look back at the 1340s, it weren't Jewish banks that were that created the situation in that collapse. These were Christian banking organizations. And, but unfortunately it has stuck with that particular ethnic group. Now, the name Rothschild is always thrown up. And in Saturn Death Cult, anybody who reads Saturn Death Cult can see where I'm alluding to the Rothschild influence and so on down through things. The Rothschilds happen to be Jewish. They're not banking stalwarts because they're Jewish. they happen to be Jewish.
Right.
Because the Rockefellers are not Jewish. And they're another lot that are dragged in on the, you know, the whole sort of conspiracy side of things. Yes, the conspiracy, in my opinion, exists. It exists in a very nasty way. But it's a red herring, you know, to go entirely down the Jewish line, because, you know, there's just as many goyim out there who are quite happy to get in on the act.
And that's a fair point. I mean, of course, no entire group of people is responsible for the acts of one member of their particular group or a small number of members. But it is weird that the themes of money and religion are so more connected than we give them credit for in modern times. And why shouldn't they be? Because they're probably the two most useful tools of control. So why wouldn't groups of people use both tools to reap the biggest rewards?
Well, you see, when you write a book called Saturn Death Cult, something that sounds incredibly lurid, okay, you know, yeah. You know, people obviously are expecting, I get a lot of people who say, you know, where are the stories about satanic ritual sacrifice, you know, all this sort of stuff, you know, where's the air reference to the devil, or, you know, this kind of thing. And I should say to anybody who's out there who's in doubt, I personally, at a personal level, class myself a Christian, but my understanding is it is not the devil that is the root of all evil. It is the love of money that is designated as the root of all evil when it comes to biblical stuff. I'm, you know, whatever anybody's concept of a devil, of anybody's concept of a Satan is or whatever, it's actually he will exploit money more than whatever power he's supposed to have, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
In other words, what I'm saying is that the love of money is actually identified as the root cause for all the problems that we have. And in that term, the love of money means the love of accumulating via debt. All right. You know,
right.
If you love money, you're never going to release somebody. You know, you're never going to give forgiveness, you know, in a Christian sense. And, you know, this is what I think it's a wonderful solution for me, because it crosses all religious boundaries. It crosses all cultural boundaries. It crosses all racial boundaries.
Right, right.
It's a logic anybody can see, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think that's a good approach and a good philosophy. So knowing what you know about the elite and this hidden history of the solar system and finance and Saturn, can you extrapolate any information on what the elite are planning for the future or how exactly they're trying to shape the next few years? Any ideas?
Yeah, sure. Well, quite obviously, the sort of the adoption of the evolutionary idea, you know, in the modern age, it basically means that the elite are planning the next evolutionary step. And instead of it coming through a messiah or a god or anything like that, some people will throw up Luciferianism or Illuminism as a credo behind all this. But effectively, what we're talking about is an evolutionary step facilitated by our own technological know-how and our own technical abilities. Some of this technology is rooted in ritual, particularly number-based ritual and so on. But the elite are looking to that next step where we inherit a golden age through our own means. And come hook or by crook, they are going to facilitate that. But to facilitate that, they need the resources of this world, and they need us to work those resources for them.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a technologically based transhuman theme to what I see developing in the world, this idea that our next evolutionary step, as the filmmaker Kubrick explored with 2001, Space Odyssey, to become star children,
mm-hmm.
And such, you know, this is believed that they can sort of develop this through technological means and be masters of their own destiny. But it still comes back to that whole idea that they are, that they're doing it on the backs of us.
Mm-hmm.
The more nefarious thing that I allude to in Saturn Death Cult is that part of the plan is to cull the Earth, basically to return the Earth, to rewild it. You know, the idea that one of the ways that they can ensure long-term rulership of the Earth is to limit the amount of us on the Earth so that we don't overwhelm them by sheer force of numbers.
Right.
And this is where you start, you know, and certain people start talking about, hey, you know, if I could come back as a virus to wipe out humanity, I would. And we're supposed to think these people are wonderful environmentalists and so on. No, they're just straightforward psychopathic elitists whose, you know, intent is – they never talk about wiping themselves out. They never take the example and apply it to themselves.
Right.
But, you know, their use of Malthusian economics and so on to justify their cause, their scaremongering on certain environmental topics, all this thing is designed to – make us sort of believe, yeah, well, it was inevitable that, you know, we're going to have to reduce ourselves from 9 billion in the future down to 500 million. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people to go in one fell swoop. but you know, Greg, it ties back in to that whole thing. Hey, there was a doomsday once where a catastrophic event created those kinds of casualties on a percentage basis.
Right.
So why not have another one, you know?
Yeah, a simulated one.
Why not bring in the new golden age? With the same kind of event that destroyed the old golden age.
Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting because the concept of wanting to be a god is always considered to be pretty taboo. And, you know, black magic goes into that realm of, oh, you know, we want to try to create the universe. And this is interesting because with this depopulation agenda, you could see it as less people means less transfer of information and they can usher in their own cataclysm. And I've heard some researchers in the Breakaway Civilization thread talk about ushering in a giant collapse and total disaster, and then they might head out to space for a few decades and come back as the new gods. And if that were true, if that was a real possibility, mm-hmm. depopulation would be key because you'd have to keep the information from being off the, you'd have to keep it off the earth, keep people from transferring that information so you could come back and then tell all these ignorant people the story and recreate this whole cycle that we might have been in for a long, long time.
Yes, I think that's pretty well much on the money in terms of a plan. How advanced they are, how feasible it is on their behalf, I don't know. Where I differ from a lot of the breakaway civilization oriented, you know, sort of stories that utilize the breakaway civilization, I'm in full agreement with the idea that there is a breakaway civilization. Of that, I'm absolutely certain. But where I'm in disagreement is I actually do not believe they have any control over the current collapse. There are people who believe that they're purposefully collapsing the financial system.
Uh-huh.
I actually believe that is the miscalculation they've made, you know, in this whole sort of deal, that it's actually getting away from them. And the reason that I believe that is because, you know, I've developed a sort of an understanding, particularly through the writings of Joseph P. Farrell and so on, that there is a third influence in the world that is what you would call the Nazi International, the vestiges of that power base that was defeated supposedly in the Second World War, but has become a suprastate existence in the world. They have enormous financial clout, and right now you're seeing the marker that they put down at the end of the Second World War being called in. And this is why you have all these bailouts going on and so on. The Anglo-American banking elite are in an absolute panic. And basically, there is a growing influence. And, you know, I've been on the record as far back as 2011 saying this. But coming out of China, coming out of Russia, there seems to be a, you know, sort of a, how can I, a different influence that is at odds with the Anglo-American banking establishment.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly believe that, you know, what we're seeing in Ukraine, what we're seeing in Syria is at the very tip of the iceberg of what's actually going on in the struggle, where the Anglo-American banking elite are, you know, they're basically on the way out. And I think that's a great thing.
Right. Yeah. Like maybe these breakaway civilization ideas are just their contingency plan because they're losing control. That makes perfect sense. I've also heard people talk about the idea of why in the past few decades we've seen so much anti-Muslim ever since 9/11 and we're going hard at the Middle East. A lot of that is these banking structures trying to expand their markets to keep them afloat just a little while longer, kick the can down the road.
Yeah, well, you see, it's the one part of what you would call the international finance system that still adheres to a non-interest ethic. And, you know, that if you just take that dictum, the root of all evil is the love of money. money is going to be at the core of what's going on there. But, you know, for me, the big issue is watch what the Chinese are doing with gold. Watch what the Russians have been doing with gold, and watch their relationship, particularly with Germany, because I believe that these guys are going to introduce a commodity-backed system that is going to completely destroy the effectiveness of the fiat U.S. dollar reserve currency system, the petrodollar system. I don't think that's the end of the equation. You know, I'm not a great fan of commodity-backed money either. It has its own problems. But I think that's the phase that we're in at the moment. And I would always advise people to watch very, very carefully. For me, it's the relationship between Russia and Germany that's the most interesting thing happening at a socio-economic geopolitical level.
Yeah, and Germany's got a rich history of interesting financial structures. And man, we could just talk about this stuff all day. It has been super eye-opening. And in the beginning, I wasn't sure why the elite would want to keep this secret, because it's just like, oh, you know, there used to be a different sun, big deal. But now, you know, everything that they've built hinges on that. So to keep the one secret, you know, it would all unravel. You hear people talk about that, a mountain of lies, you know, one lie begets the next, and you're hot on the heels of revealing that truth.
There's a reason they stick that ridiculous eye on the US dollar bill.
Yeah.
You know? It's there for a reason, which is so out of bounds in terms of rational thought, but it actually makes sense when you understand it as a control mechanism, in terms of our deep-rooted subconsciousness.
Man. Yeah, Troy, this has been an amazing time. I really think it would be awesome if we did a follow-up sometime, but we are getting...
Anytime.
Nice. Yeah. I mean, it's just fascinating ideas, man. And you have to do so much groundwork to replace the basis that so many people have for history of money, history of the solar system. It's a huge topic. You're undoing decades of learning indoctrination to give people real learning. So I think that's great. But before we go, would you like to tell the people about your website or anything else you're working on?
Yeah, well, the website is satandeathcult.com, there is an ebook. There's an ebook version which has a little bit more material than is on the website. You can buy that's it gives you a little bit more sort of background to some of the cosmology and some of the science around certain things. But yeah, visit the website. I'm pleased to say that over the last year, I've also released a second book, which is much more inclined towards the cosmology and answers questions of what the solar system, our solar system as it is now, looked like before the arrival of Saturn and Earth. I've done that in conjunction with an author called Ted Holden. It's a book called Cosmos and Collision. You'll see it advertised on my website. And it acts like a prequel to Saturn Death Cult, but it's much more sort of geared towards cosmology and academic referencing than Saturn Death Cult is. So check that out if the cosmology appeals to you.
Awesome. Well, Troy, it has been a real pleasure. I'm definitely down to do it again sometime. There's so much more meat on these bones. But until then, man, take care of yourself. All right.
Thanks very much, Greg. I really enjoyed myself. Cheers.
There it is, people. Another show in the bag, which will forever change the way I speculate about the ancient past. And I hope you can agree. Might the world not be 10,000 years old, literally, but maybe that's the date the hardcore Christians use because it's the birth of the modern world. But little do they know that. Maybe it explains mammoths in the Arctic region and stories of a global golden age, a paradise, an Eden, if you will. Is this what Stanley Kubrick was trying to tell us? Does this explain the giant skeletons that have been found? Lots of things to think about as you tuck your pretty little self into bed tonight, fill out those all-important forms, or stock the shelves of perpetual predatory capitalism, and I am happy to distract your mind ever so slightly while you deal with whatever it is the Saturn Death Cult is throwing at you. Please share the show with your friends, sign up for the Plus Show at thehiresidechatsplus.com, or throw $5 in the money bomb, or just keep listening. I love you guys. Your move, members of the Saturn Death Cult. Your fucking move.
I always believed that if I ran out to India, wore sandals and shaved my head, and used Body Shop conditioner, burn incense like crazy, I could call myself a spirit head. But I only went to India to look on top.
I wore sandals cause I'd smoked all my money, and I shaved off all my hair cause I had the fleas. I'd been sleeping all over, and the body shop conditioner was a present from a friend, and the incense used to hide the smell of the drug den where I lay. Yeah. And so I ask myself what my motives are for this lying need to look so free. And if I tell myself real honestly, what more can I admit to? Open up a door, he said, I'm gonna find out what I'm here for. He said, I'd find out soon. I got too much Saturn, not enough food. I always believed that if I never missed a yoga class, read my horoscope in the dailies, and recycled bottles and know a red Indian, I could call myself a spirit man. But I was only doing yoga cause I fancied the teacher, and stars cause it looked good on paper. And I only went to church cause my granny gave me money when confession was over. And I only knew the Indian cause his brother's a dealer, and bottles had a price on their return, so I could go and play. Oh my, my. And so I ask myself what my motives are for this lying need to look so free. And if I tell myself real honestly, what more can I admit to? Open up a door, he said, I'm gonna find out what I'm here for. He said, I'd find out soon. I got too much Saturn, not enough moon. I'm here for, he said, I'd find out soon. I got too much Saturn. How can I admit it? Open up a door, he said, I'm gonna find out what I'm here for. He said, I'd find out soon. I got too much Saturn.
Grateful and we're thankful and we're spiritual. If we're so don't let your spirit die. Lay down your arms and we'll walk together into the light. I cannot get to sleep cause I feel so angry. It's gonna take a while. Cause the old disease put a resentment in me and the inability to smile. And it's a joke to think I'm hurting you when I'm really hurting me. I've been beating myself for so long now that it comes so naturally. And if we're grateful and we're thankful, if we're hiding, we're denying all the love inside. So don't let your spirit die. Lay down your arms and we'll walk together into the I feel it.